Reserve's pause on interest rate hikes came with a warning from Chairman Jerome Powell. It may not last for long.
Inflation has not really moved down. It has not so far reacted much to our existing rate hikes, and so we're going to have to keep at it.
Inflation has come down from its peak of 9% to 4%, but the Fed wants to get it to 2%. Over the course of 15 months and 10 straight interest rate hikes, the 30-year fixed mortgage rate has risen to nearly 7%. Credit card rates have soared to more than 20%.
The question for anyone sitting at home is, will these interest rates come down fast enough so that I can borrow money when I want to at a more affordable rate? I think it's safe to assume that the cost of servicing a loan or getting a new loan is going to remain high for the foreseeable future.
I think about the FOMO phase that it feels like we're in right now, where you're getting a lot of, ooh, that looks interesting and it sounds interesting, but where's the actual substance come into play? And what does that timeline look like for some of these AI companies, if you will, right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, let's put some numbers on the foam there.
Sure.
And I agree 100%. So the CEO of AMD said it's a $30 billion market today. Mm-hmm. It'll be a $150 billion market 5 years from now. Right. How much market cap did NVIDIA add in the last month? You're looking about $300 or $400 billion. And that's an 80% capture of the market. So if AMD can put a dent in that, there's still way more market cap being added than probably the size of the entire AI market. It's definitely exciting. It's definitely a technological breakthrough. But the same thing happened to Microsoft in the late 1990s with the advent of the internet and Microsoft Office and Windows. They dominated the market from 2000 to 2010. Microsoft doubled their operating income, but the stock went down 40% over that 10-year period because there was just too much froth.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
All the major indexes finished out on Friday on a down note, but for the week, all major indexes were up. The market's generally ignoring Fed statements made on Wednesday. The Fed paused this month but hinted at more rate hikes are coming and that there would be no rate reductions for several years. Well, the markets aren't buying that story as the indexes all moved higher this week. The Fed dot plot does peg the majority of Fed governors forecasting at least one more rate hike this year, which could come as soon as next month or possibly in September as inflation remains sticky. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck, David Keller joins me from Stock Charts. David thinks there's a bubble developing in AI stocks and growing disparities between the major indexes and the unweighted versions of the same index. He believes this is looking more like a bear market rally rather than a new bull market. Later on, Rick Sharga, CEO of CJ Patrick Company, will be on the program as we discuss the real estate market, which is in the doldrums due to high mortgage rates. We're also going to be looking at a deteriorating commercial real estate market, which could portend more troubles for the banking industry, as well as which states offer new home buyers the best chance to be able to afford a new home. But first, let's find out the events moving the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Stocks climbed this week despite new knowledge that Fed officials are predicting higher rates to come. There's been a lot of talk about fear of missing out, otherwise known as FOMO, driving stocks higher despite the hawkish Fed and fund flow data that shows investors are getting out of stocks and moving to bonds. Economic data this week did not point towards dire hard landing evidence, and this may also be another reason supporting recent stock returns. Turning towards that, the NASDAQ closed up 3.25% this week. The S&P 500 rose 2.5%. The Dow Industrials were up 1.25%, and the Russell 2000 was up 0.5%. Oil closed at $71.93, up 2.5%. Gold was mainly flat on the week, closing at $19.71. The two-year Treasury note finished the week at 4.71%, and the 10-year Treasury note finished the week at 3.77%. Both between the two still deeply inverted. The main driver this week was the Fed meeting on Wednesday. It has long been anticipated the Fed would skip raising rates this meeting based on comments from Vice Chair nominee and Fed Governor Jefferson a couple of weeks ago, which shifted the narrative from some of the other more hawkish non-voters who wanted to see a hike. Sure enough, Wednesday the Fed announced no rate hikes. but it released its quarterly summary of economic projections, which raised projections for the Fed funds rate up to 5.6% from 5.1% previously. 2024's median projections and 2025 were also each revised higher, supporting the higher for longer policy rate outlook. These projections are in stark contrast to the futures market, which is predicting cuts later this year. The initial knee-jerk reaction to the news before Chairman Powell spoke was a sell-off in stocks as a result of the higher rate projections. Powell reiterated that the July meeting will be a live meeting, meaning they could or they could not raise rates. But with still several meetings to go this year, investors warmed to the idea the Fed could be done and, based on economic data, is assuming a hard landing can be avoided. There have been a lot of mixed views on this opinion in the financial community this week, as some recent comments have likened the recent run-up to 1999 and the summer of 2008, both big rallies right before major corrections. Michael Hartnett of Bank of America said, you know, bears, we've gotten it wrong, but he still alluded that we should see a correction very soon. And Francois Trahan also shared his views respectively, both not convinced a new bull market has begun, despite the technicians calling otherwise. In other news this week, the European Central Bank raised rates a quarter point for the three lending facilities. The Bank of Japan left theirs at negative 10 basis points, while the People's Bank of China cut rates 10 basis points to 2.65%. News of China cutting rates this week came just as we received economic news around weaker than expected retail sales, industrial production, and fixed asset investment data for May. On the economic front for the U.S. this week, data was mixed. Before the Fed meeting, we received the consumer price index for May, which decelerated more to a year-over-year of 4% growth versus 4.9% in April, while core was up 5.3% versus 5.5% previously. The producer price index contracted 0.3% month over month. Now, for the regional surveys in June, the Philadelphia Fed index slumped deeper to negative 13.7, while the Empire State survey jumped back above in a positive territory at 6.6. Industrial production declined 0.2% in May, and retail sales increased 0.3% in May, showing the consumer is still resilient. Jobless claims have held steady on the week at 262,000. Finally, on Friday, the preliminary University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index for June showed a huge drop in year-ahead inflation expectations, down to 3.3% from 4.2%. I was rather surprised stocks held steady on Friday despite the advances in stocks this week and this month. It was a quadruple witchy options exercise day Friday for stocks index futures, stock index options, stock options, and single stock futures derivatives, which happens four times a year, which typically sees volumes surge. Volatility was expected but didn't come Friday, while decliners did lead advancers by a slim margin on the NYSE. There's been an interesting development for how bullish investors are and where they're investing. The AAII Sentiment Survey comes out weekly and has shown investors have turned bullish this month, with 45% saying they are bullish compared to 29% 2 weeks ago as of this Wednesday. And as mentioned earlier, ICI fund flow data shows investors have been pulling money out of ETFs consistently for the past month, including as of the June 14th date, with $8.7 billion on average flowing out of domestic stock equity funds each week. About $4.8 billion a week has flowed into taxable bond funds on average for the past month. So there's some interesting discrepancies between where investors' money is and where their mouth is between these two resources. But that's it for this week, summarized as a central bank meeting week. We got rate increases and decreases from the US, or pause, European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, and China. And then finally, the fear of missing out rally, also known as the FOMO rally, pushing returns higher continually this year on AI news and a Fed skip recently this month. Up next, this week's guest technician, David Keller.
In terms of reading the tea leaves of the price action, through 2008, there were two 20% plus rallies in the S&P 500. And for the Russell 2000, one of them was actually 34%. And that was before the market hit new lows. So, you know, 20% off of the lows as a new bull market is sort of an arbitrary title. I would say it's important to keep in mind what the Fed's incentives are this cycle. So in 2018, Chair Powell famously pivoted really quickly when the data changed. I think this cycle is probably going to be different from that. You've got core inflation still comping at around 5% annualized with really no signs of turning lower. And the base effects are going to start to wear off over the next month or two for CPI inflation and PCE inflation. And also the Fed has said that they don't want to ease policy before they have very clear line of sight into sustained 2% inflation. So I think to expect policy to pivot toward easing at any point in the next 6 to 9 months is very, very unlikely.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the Fed met this week as widely expected. They didn't raise interest rates. But what was more important is what they said afterwards. More interest rate hikes are coming, and they said it would be at least 2 years before they would lower interest rates. Well, the market seems to be ignoring that. Going on the AI buzz that is all the talk on Wall Street. Where's all this heading? Joining us from Stock Charts is David Keller. And Dave, I wonder if you might focus on the S&P because you've got basically seven stocks. It's called the S&P 7 versus the other 493. I wonder if you'd comment on that and what's your take when you see something like this?
You know, it's so interesting, Jim, and it's great to talk to you as always. You know, when you think about, we've talked about the concept of narrow leadership in 2023. And I think if you just look at year-to-date returns on that small number of, you know, mega cap names, right, huge stocks that you talked about, relative to the rest of the market, if you sort of mentally push away those largest 10 names and just look at the other 490, the 2023 has not been a particularly strong year. It's actually been quite mixed. And if you look at certain areas of the market, in consumer, in energy, in healthcare, in industrials, it's actually been a pretty challenging year. Financials, right, of course, as well. So you have this issue where there's a huge disparity between the stocks that are working and the stocks that are not. When I look at the S&P and the NASDAQ and their performance year to date, it really drives home what I would say is an index construction problem. When we think about our benchmarks, they are very growth oriented and they are very geared toward those largest names. The top 10 stocks in the S&P are about the same weight as the bottom 400 would be about an estimate based on where they're at right now. So they have significant impact. So when those stocks are doing well, the benchmarks are doing fine. But depending on what stocks you own in 2023, it's not been a particularly successful year. It's probably been pretty frustrating. But that creates a feedback loop where more and more investors feel the need to rotate into those biggest names, which just causes these trends to persist. And that's where we're at here in June.
You know what this harkens back to, Dave, and I'd like to get your thoughts here. This reminds me of the markets in 1999. We had a bubble going in the internet, the new technology that was going to change the economy and the world, just as they're saying the same thing with AI. And back then, you didn't value companies on earnings or, let's say, sales. It was eyeball clicks or something like that.
One thing I've learned in my time in the investment industry is anytime we start trying to justify high valuations by something other than a traditional measure of success, I think we're in a dangerous scenario. And there's a lot of similarities. Anyone that was investing in the late 90s to early 2000s, you remember that sort of sensation where a small number of names in that technology, sort of the early internet names, could do no wrong. And they were being valued based on the potential of an idea that may manifest down the road. But, you know, in terms of structural, tangible results today, they were left wanting. And eventually the market realizes that, sort of wakes up. And a bubble as it's forming is incredibly difficult to recognize and certainly to fight, right? The left side of a bubble can be very difficult if you're on the wrong side of it. But I would argue that with the AI frenzy that we've seen, we're seeing a very similar idea about how to justify extremely high valuations. And the two things I will tell you is bubbles have been a part of investment history going back to the South Sea bubble, Tulip Mania. How many other ones can we name that all have a similar sort of rhyme to them? But the key is at some point they end. And so I think looking for traditional signs of euphoria, looking for signs of a market being overextended, and looking for the beginnings of rotation can be a really important part of the toolkit here going into, honestly, the seasonally weakest part of the year.
You know, it's interesting because we're being told right now you can't really look at the PE ratio. Like NVIDIA is selling at 208 times earnings. Advanced Micro is selling at 284 times earnings. And you have companies like Apple that are almost equal to the GDP of Germany. I mean, that just goes to tell you where we've gone.
Well, and we talk about market caps, talk about how many stocks are above $1 trillion market cap. I remember when that was first, you know, we're talking about Apple, you know, maybe getting to $1 trillion market cap. And now you're seeing more and more sort of get into that group. There's no denying that the trend has been incredibly strong. And I think the challenge for investors is you can't fight those, right? I mean, if you don't own names like Apple or Meta or Amazon or Tesla in 2023, it's been a really challenging year, particularly for institutional money managers. I think that's something to remember. If you're a portfolio manager at a large investment house and you're trying to outperform the S&P 500, there is a career risk to not owning those names. And that sort of, again, tends to perpetuate these trends. At some point, the music stops. And at some point, we sort of realize that valuations are extremely, you know, overplayed, and then things start to come back. And I think the challenge for investors, and again, what I always tell people is compare it to flying. You don't develop your exit strategy when the plane starts going down. You do it when everything's fine. When you're flying straight and level, there are no issues. So the market overall, I mean, based on the benchmarks, has been fairly strong. Now's the time to be, if you're in those names, to be thinking about your exit strategy. What would you see from those stocks that would tell you that this song is now over, and make sure that you protect your capital if and when a downtrend comes, which it certainly will at some point.
And we saw that. And I wonder if we might spend a few moments in talking about the way the indexes work. The larger the capitalization of a company, the more weight it carries in the index. So when an investor puts a dollar in an S&P 500 index fund, a good majority of that is going to these 10 stocks. Conversely, as we saw last year, I mean, some of these, you know, stocks like Amazon lost 44%. Microsoft was over 30. Apple, I think, lost about 30. But when money comes out of the indexes, when investors panic, then the same thing happens in reverse. These stocks get hit the hardest.
That's exactly right. And what a market cap weighted index, something like the S&P or the NASDAQ, they're really geared, they're weighted heavily to the largest names. And it's not just a little bit, it's a lot, right? So one stock like a Microsoft is worth about 50 to 100 smaller names in the same index. So what happens to Microsoft has the same impact as 50, 60, 70 other companies all doing, you know, different things. And that shows you how much of a narrow sort of top heavy calculation, even with sector ETFs. And a lot of people, I think, when you look at the XLY for consumer discretionary, the XLK for technology, people expect that they're sort of diversifying around that sector. And the reality is you're not. If you buy the XLY, you're basically owning Amazon and Tesla and a little Home Depot, and then a bunch of other things that don't have much impact. If you own technology, you're owning Microsoft and Apple, which are about 50% of the XLK, and then NVIDIA and some semiconductors, and then it sort of falls out from there. So they help those, when they are doing well, it helps those ETFs, and certainly the broad ETFs like the NASDAQ, the SPY, to do very, very well. But if and when those things rotate lower, which they will at some point, the pain can be equally as difficult to the downside. So I think a lot of times it's that caveat emptor, right? Let the buyer beware. I would make sure when you're looking at an index, when you're looking at an ETF, really look at the construction and look what exposures you have. A lot of people have a very narrow bet on Apple and Microsoft, and that's it. But they're not aware of it because they feel like they're diversified because of ETFs.
And I want to talk about something that people forget. When you get these extreme valuations that are in a bubble, as we saw with the internet stocks, as we're seeing with AI stocks, People forget that the NASDAQ went nowhere for almost 17 years. In other words, it went nowhere for 15 years. And then I think it was 2015 and 2016, we briefly had these false breakouts those 2 years, and then it would fall right back out. And I think if I'm correct, it was somewhere around February of 2017 when the NASDAQ finally broke out.
That sounds right. And I would say it behooves investors to do a good analysis of market history. And I think that's one of the great things that I've learned in my career is looking back at previous cycles, you know, thinking about what's happening now versus the late 90s versus the early 2000s. What signs did we see that a market was, you know, becoming very overvalued? What signs did we see that technology bubble was forming and then had popped? And how did you recognize the rotation away from offense into defense? And I think that's super important. The amount of time that it takes for markets to recover after coming down from high valuations, it takes way longer than people realize. I think just recently, people were probably caught off guard with 2022 and just how long that downtrend played out. I remember in, you know, February, March, people are already calling for a bottom because we'd pulled back a couple months. And in my mind, I'm thinking, boy, I've been through some bear market phases. They can last way longer than you expect. So I think it's certainly, and you know, for me as a technical analyst, I think it's important to focus on the trends, focus on the relative performance of some of these groups. Right now, we're very, you know, it's dominated by the growth sectors of technology, communication services, consumer discretionary. Look for signs of rotation to defense. We've seen a little bit of that this week with things like utilities, you know, starting to pop up a little bit, real estate as well. Those sort of areas of the market start to do better. That would tell me that investors are just the beginnings of institutions rooting more to a defensive positioning.
Yeah, I'm looking at a Bloomberg chart of the NASDAQ, and it was actually the first quarter of 2017 that we actually broke out and took out the whole old highs. And then also the big run-up, which we really saw during the pandemic. And it was interesting, David, I was looking at the financials of these tech stocks. And 2020 and 2021 was the big run-up. And we were in a lockdown. So we were shopping on Amazon. We were doing Zoom. We were doing things that helped these tech stocks. And then I took a look at what happened last year and what happened this year. And what you're seeing is exactly what you would expect to see, David, when the economy's slowing down and possibly heading into recession. Earnings are down. Sales growth is down. Profit margins that are down, debt is up. And that's exactly what you see when the economy slows down or you're heading into a recession.
If it's funny, Jim, if you ignore everything we've talked about, ignore the trends, ignore the strength and the performance of some of these names, and just look at the reality of where we're at and the macroeconomic data. And there are so many clear signs that we are, you know, in that recessionary transition. You know, think about just the inflation and the overall the shape of the yield curve. All of these things, earnings have been underwhelming, right? So if you think about it, this is a market that's rallying not because the fundamental backbone of these companies is so strong. It's this expectation or maybe a wishful thinking that we're in a recovery mode. I think this market and certainly investors are so eager for a recovery and so afraid of missing out on the next recovery, it's causing a lot of these stocks to maybe get way ahead of themselves, lean a little bit too far over their skis, as it were. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we're entering the seasonally weakest part of the year. So I would say as these stocks have rallied, as names like Microsoft, Apple sort of at or near all-time highs, it certainly to me starts to think, are we so overextended that now we start to retreat into a fall low, which is actually pretty common in a pre-election year?
You know, the other thing that kind of strikes me about this is the media, you know, if we take a look at the financial media where people get a lot of their news, they're either selling greed or they're selling fear. And what we don't get from the media is reason and rationality.
I think that's up to the investor to bring that to the table on their own, I believe, right? And you're absolutely right. I think, you know, for financial media, the goal is to, you know, in general, the goal is to sensationalize every little data point And to, you know, to think of the extremes and really, and I would argue sell fear all around. It's FOMO. It's the fear of missing out on the upside. It's the fear of losing everything on the downside, but it's all playing on our anxiety because it's unknown. The, you know, the markets, as with life, are unknown. We don't know what's going to happen. All we can do is base our, you know, bet our portfolio, bet our assets based on the probable outcome that we would expect. At the end of the day, I think it, for investors, more often than not, it's important to take a step back, step away from what I call the flickering ticks of the short-termism of the markets and certainly the financial media, really focus on overall trends and larger signs of secular shifts in the market. And again, when I any reason why I would be bullish right now is based on prices that have gone up. The reasons why I would be bearish or certainly cautious at this point are the reasons that you mentioned. Are the conditions really setting us up for a broad rally beyond what we've seen so far? I think that's a very big question mark in June of 2023.
You know, the other thing is a student of history of the markets. Usually a sector will dominate the markets for a decade. You know, whether it was companies in the 80s that were consolidating and buying stocks, it was tech stocks in the 90s, commodities in the 00 decade, and then basically towards the latter part of this last decade, it was tech stocks, but it was, you know, big blue chip stocks, bonds. So whenever you see something dominate a sector in the markets for a decade, we go through, let's say, a recession, we go through a bear market, and when we come out of that, you have a change in leadership. Could you see something like that happening again? Because what really strikes me is I look at commodities historically, and they're probably the most undervalued I've seen them in 100 years. I'd like to get your take on sector leadership coming out of a downturn.
That's a really thoughtful question, Jim. And I would agree with you. I think, you know, I guess there's two parts to it. You know, number one, you know, thinking of the AI trade that I would say is really fueling the gains that we've seen in a relatively narrow group of sectors year to date. And it certainly came out, it seemed to come out of nowhere, even though the this move toward, you know, better and better artificial intelligence has certainly been a trend. It's been an exclamation point here in the last couple of months. What's happening right now is investors are really piling into the names that are obvious AI plays, right? NVIDIA, you know, with the backbone of the ability of companies to leverage AI, stocks like Microsoft and Apple, which are directly, you know, incorporating artificial intelligence. But I would argue the way that we get to other areas of the market leading is think about where all AI actually plays out, right? Industrial companies like a Caterpillar is very much investing in AI. They're, you know, they're looking at autonomous driving for heavy construction equipment. And that's just one example. I, you know, the while we certainly assume that AI is going to be an important theme going forward, which I think is absolutely right, which companies and which areas of the market will most benefit? That's actually a big question mark, right? Sort of like Tesla versus a traditional automaker and what's the best bet for, you know, electric vehicles. It's debatable in a lot of ways over the long term, right? In the short term, you sort of see where bets are. But over time, I think something like AI becomes a very widespread phenomenon, similar to like the internet, right? Every company has an active presence online, whereas before it was a relatively small company, a set of companies that do so. I think that's one way that the leadership starts to spread out a little bit, and certainly to more, you know, to other areas of the market like industrials. I would say with commodities, for example, you know, when you think about the big picture, this is an area of the market that's been struggling on a relative basis for quite some time. I'm thinking of the energy sector, thinking of the materials sector. You know, gold stocks up until 6 to 8 weeks ago had been one of the stronger parts of the market in 2023. I think there's opportunity for material stocks in particular to really improve. The commodity space has been relatively low. Crude oil prices have remained relatively low compared to what you might expect at this point in the cycle. I would look for that as a contrarian play. If you think about overheated, overvalued technology stocks and what might happen, what would take up the slack there and where would assets go? And I think that might be an important space to look, Jim.
And here's something that I think is going to come up, and you're just starting to hear it. These big data centers that drive all of this consume enormous amounts of energy to run these data centers. And now you have politicians, I call them the banana greens, that are talking about climate change of these data centers, that they're basically emitting too much, burning too much energy and creating too much use of fossil fuels for these data centers?
I think it's a very real issue. I think with a lot of development over time, there are those unintended consequences. And I would say with electric vehicles, it's the same idea. You know, the move toward electric vehicles is very much, I think, for a lot of consumers, it's motivated by sort of a green mentality and trying to, be environmentally friendly and environmentally focused. And I think that comes from a good place for a lot of people. But when you think about it, actually building an electric vehicle consumes a lot of energy. Powering that, how you actually, when you plug it in, where is the energy coming from? These are all reliant on traditional energy infrastructure. And so I think the same thing happened with cryptocurrencies, which is this great, decentralized currency or decentralized economy that comes out. But it turns out mining cryptocurrencies consumes a ton of energy. And so I think those sort of second order effects of a lot of these developments are sort of underappreciated and underexposed when investors recognize. And I think when people actually recognize how that all comes together, that's an opportunity for those areas of the market that have probably been underperforming. Again, I think it plays to what we discuss, energy, materials. Those areas of the market probably stand to benefit the most from sort of that wake up of recognizing where what actually fuels a lot of the change that we're seeing in the industries today.
So, Dave, summing up, I think this is a bear market rally. That's just my opinion. And especially what the Fed just said, I think they're in a no-win situation. If they raise rates, they could create a credit crisis. If they don't raise rates, we could have a return of inflation. So they're really in a no-win situation. So the macro backdrop is deteriorating. I assume, Dave, if people are chasing these stocks, you would probably tell them you better have an exit plan, maybe put some stops in or puts or something to protect yourself, because there's a good chance you're going to get whacked here.
The good news, Jim, and I would agree with you. I think the good news is there are more opportunities and more levers that individual investors, financial advisors can pull to protect yourself from potential downside. I think using the options market in creative ways to protect and limit your downside risk is important. Having stops, particularly in areas of the market that have been so strong. And I don't blame people for getting into names like Alphabet and Amazon and Tesla and Nvidia. I mean, they've been strong stocks that have continued to strengthen. And as a trend follower by training, I think those are incredibly strong trends. But I also know that all trends come to an end at some point. And I think, and guessing when the music is going to stop is actually very, very difficult. Recognizing and admitting when the music stops is what investors actually struggle with, right? When a trade has been working and then it stops working, our brain does all sorts of creative things to protect our ego and tell you that it's going to be okay. I would say set some rules now, and when those stops are triggered, don't think another moment about it. Unwind, protect your capital, and live to invest another day.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as we close, tell people about Stock Charts. It's one of my favorite software programs. You have a page where you take a look at the market. You've got everything from the major indexes to the sectors to global to commodities to cryptos to market stats. I mean, it's my go-to page when I wake up in the morning, because on one page, I can go around the globe and every single asset class and see where things are heading.
No, I appreciate it very much, Jim. I do what's called the morning coffee routine first thing every day. I bring up stockcharts.com. I start with our dashboard and I just try to gather information, right? Try to understand what's happening and focus on the longer term. I think for a lot of investors, it's very easy to get sucked into the short term movements, what's happening this minute. I think for a lot of investors, thinking more medium term, longer term is much more helpful. By analyzing trends, by using our proprietary stock charts technical ranking, which really focuses on trend performance over time, really helps you lean into areas of the market that are strong, lean away from markets that are weaker, and recognizing when those shifts are occurring. I think we're right on the cusp of one of those major shifts here going into the summer, and I'll certainly be watching stock charts to recognize when those shifts have played out.
All right. The website is stockcharts.com. Dave, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
It was a pleasure, Jim. Thanks so much.
There were very, very high expectations at the beginning of the year for how the Chinese economy would recover. The idea, especially emanating from a lot of investment banks, was that as soon as the zero COVID Band-Aid is ripped off, consumers are going to go berserk spending. The property sector will start to look a lot better too. And you're going to get a very big economic boom this year in China, which led to the banks putting out GDP growth forecasts upwards of 5.5%, some at 6.5%. Some even went to go above 7% in their growth forecast. Now, as you may recall from our last conversation, we were very much opposed to that idea. We didn't think that the recovery would be nearly as strong and certainly not sustained.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Hi, I'm Jim Poplava. I started Financial Sense in 1985 to give clients a boutique, personal investment experience that's hard to get at a large company. For three decades, my company has been helping families build, manage, and protect their wealth through tailored financial planning and investment management. If you are looking to make financial sense of a complex world, give our office a call at 888-486-3939 to speak with one of our advisors today and let us help you plan your future.
Joining us on the program is Rick Sharga. He's founder and CEO of CJ Patrick Company. Rick, as we take a look at mortgage rates, what are they getting close to 7%? Yet housing inventory still remains sort of tight. Does that surprise you?
No, it did. Thanks for having me on today, Jim. It doesn't surprise me because people are expecting demand to be weaker, but they forget that those high mortgage rates have an impact on supply as well. Over 70% of homeowners with an active mortgage have a mortgage rate below 4%. And none of those homeowners who don't have to move are particularly excited with the opportunity of trading in their 2.5% or 3.5% mortgage, buying a more expensive house with a 7% mortgage. So inventory levels are probably going to remain low for the foreseeable future until interest rates settle back down a little bit.
You know, it's interesting. We're doing a financial plan for an individual that's getting ready to retire. And what they're ending up doing, instead of moving because they locked in, they got a very, very low mortgage rate, they're just going to add on to the redo their kitchen, bathrooms, add on some about 500 feet to the house off the family room. And they found that that would be much cheaper given where their mortgage is and the price they paid for the home. Are you seeing more of that? In other words, are the Home Depots going to do well because people decide, you know what, it's too expensive to move. It'll cost me more to upgrade. Maybe I'll just remodel the house.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is the increased cost of financing has accelerated a trend that was already happening. We're seeing the baby boomer generation in particular aging in place at much higher numbers and for much longer periods of time than previous generations did. And the higher mortgage rates have certainly weighed heavily on that generation's decision making. And yeah, in a lot of cases, what they're doing instead of downsizing, instead of moving into a 55 plus community or buying a new house, they're renovating their current place, making it more livable as they age. And because of that, the average length of time somebody's spending in a house has almost doubled in the last decade. So we're seeing that average length of time go up as high as 12 years, whereas it used to be somewhere between 5 and 7. So absolutely, I think the other thing, Jim, that you didn't mention, but I know you're aware of, is we have a record level of homeowner equity across the country, about $28.5 trillion of equity. So there's plenty of money available for a lot of those folks who've been in a home for a number of years to tap into and make home renovations or do other things that they'd like to do to invest that money in.
You know, it was interesting. I was talking to another gentleman that was getting ready to retire, and they bought a house for about $250,000. I think it was in early 80s. That house is now worth about 1.6, 1.8. And I had to tell this individual that he thought he could just sell the house and then just buy. They wanted to buy some land and build a couple homes. They wanted to have homes for their kids who can't afford to own a home. And I said, well, you got a problem there because the government gives you, as a married couple, $500,000 you can exclude from capital gains tax. But anything over that, you're going to pay 25% tax on, plus you're going to have to pay the state of California. So when you add, let's say he would have been, with the gains, been an 11.3% state of California, you add that to 25%. Rick, you're talking about 36%, over a third of the profits. Is that another reason a lot of people are staying in their home?
Yeah, and a very common sense solution to this lack of inventory would be to take a look at those capital gains taxes. California, of course, has never met a tax it doesn't like, so it adds on to the problem. And not surprisingly, California has some of the lowest inventory of homes for sale of any state in the union. So yeah, making it more affordable for people to sell their homes, taking less of a bite out of the equity that they built up over many years would certainly encourage some people to move out of those properties and put that inventory back on the market for the next generation of homebuyers.
Yeah, because if you take the combination of paying heavy capital gains taxes plus higher mortgage rates, it's no wonder that people are staying in their home. Rick, are you seeing, I know the realtors are telling me, you know, if you're a million around that area and under, that market is still strong, but the McMansions are the area of the real estate market that has been declining. So if you have a McMansion, a home, 5, 6, 7, 8 million, something like that, those kind of homes are falling in price. What do you see?
That's a pretty good assessment, Jim. There's virtually no inventory available for entry-level buyers. So whatever inventory does come to market is more or less price protected. You're not going to see prices fall because there's going to be bidding wars on those properties. And the realtors I talk to across the country are basically saying the same thing, that if a property is brought to market and it's priced properly, they're getting multiple bids, not 20 like they did a year ago, but 3 or 4 or 5, which is, you know, really more than you need to get your market price. Where we are seeing some declines in prices are at the higher tiers. And the other thing is that this is a very regional correction. I've been telling people this for the last year, that my expectation was that overall home prices would drop a little bit this year nationally, but that local market conditions were going to vary wildly. So right now, if you're in the Bay Area in California, if you're in coastal California, if you're in the Pacific Northwest or some outlier markets like Boise, Idaho or Austin, Texas or Phoenix, Arizona, they've seen double-digit price drops on a year-over-year basis. On the other hand, if you're in Florida or the Carolinas or Tennessee or anywhere else in Texas other than Austin, those prices are still going up. Now they're going up 3-4%, not 20% like they did in 2021. But that's the kind of variability we're seeing across the country. So anybody who's looking to invest in real estate or anybody who's thinking about selling a piece of real estate needs to really understand their local market conditions very well and almost ignore the national headlines.
What about the builder response? You would think with the shortage of housing, I know here in San Diego, right around where I live, they have converted 2 18-hole golf courses and they're putting in multi-unit housing. So they're going to rack and stack them. But have you seen the builders, you know, the Pulteys, the big builders respond to this in any way?
No, it's kind of a tale of two worlds there, Jim. And what you just described in San Diego is really interesting. There are expected to be a record number of apartment units coming to market this year, as many as 1 million new units all coming to market in 2023. So the multifamily building market has really been very, very strong and will continue to be throughout this year. Probably not enough to cause a glut of properties nationally because vacancy rates are still very low, but there might be some markets, individual markets, that get overbuilt a little bit. At the same time, once those interest rates jumped last year and buyers exited the market for single-family homes, the builders cut back pretty dramatically. In fact, I think every month since July last year, the year-over-year housing start numbers have been down by double digits. So they got the memo this time. One of the problems we had in the great financial crisis was an oversupply of homes, and the builders never stopped building even after the buyers stopped buying. So at one point, we had about a 13-month supply of homes available for sale, which is more than twice what the market can usually handle. So the builders have been more or less on the sidelines with the single-family properties. The other thing that's really hampered their efforts is the supply chain disruptions we had for the last year or so, coupled with labor shortages. They've had a hard time finding people to work. And so they, for a while, had the highest number of properties under construction in history, just because it was taking them so long to build the property. So they're kind of working through that backlog right now, but we're not seeing a lot in terms of new permits or housing starts, which you would expect to see more of simply because there's not much available supply of existing homes.
You know, it's amazing. I had an employee that wanted to get her own apartment close to the coast. And Rick, I was just shocked. No air conditioning, 2-bedroom apartment, almost $3,000 a month. I mean, that's almost like a house payment.
And our friends in New York City would tell you that they'd line up for that because it'd be a lot cheaper than what they're currently paying for their studio apartment in Manhattan. Yeah, apartment rates went up as quickly or in some markets more quickly than home prices did for the last year. Now, we're finally starting to see that settle down and in some markets actually decline a little bit. the inventory coming to market will probably take a little bit of the pricing pressure off. But, you know, one of the things that we've seen in the last couple inflation reports, as those inflation rates have been coming down, is a recognition that rental rates have also settled down a bit. A year ago, we were looking at annual rental asking price increases of 15%. That's off the charts. A normal year, those prices go up 1% to 4%. So we have demographically driven tailwinds for both rental properties and owner-occupied properties. Millions and millions of young adults coming of age to form households. They have to live somewhere. And because of the simple laws of supply and demand, we've seen both home prices and rental rates skyrocket over the last couple of years.
What would you tell Rick, given the fact that at least on the lower end, you're getting multiple bids, what would you tell, let's say, a millennial couple that want to start a family, they want to move out an apartment, get a home to start a family? What would you tell them about this kind of market?
I would tell them that Iowa is very affordable. I'm only half kidding there, Jim. The median price of a home sold in California right now is somewhere between $750,000 and $800,000. And for your young couple getting started, that's a non-starter when it comes to home ownership. So can't tell you how many young adults I've spoken with recently. We were trying to figure out what state they're going to move to in order to become homeowners. In today's more flexible work from home environment, fortunately, there are a lot of young adults who have that option. And California lost somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000 people last year. Used to be all retirees, and now it's retirees, it's young professionals, it's adults with college degrees who are looking for more affordable lifestyles and have had to exit the state in order to become homeowners. So in the state itself, you either have to move, you know, way inland or way up north to find anything that's reasonably affordable, or you have to move out of the state. And we've seen a lot of states in the south, the southeast, and even some of the mountain states benefit from that out-migration.
Yeah, that was my next question. If you were to look, let's say you're a young couple, what areas of the country look affordable and yet have all the amenities that you would have like in a big city? You have medical, you have universities, you have shopping, you have all the things that you enjoy from a culture point of view and a lifestyle point of view. Where does that exist around the country that looks good to you?
Well, a lot of people voted for Boise a couple of years ago, which surprised me until I did a little bit of research on Boise. It's a university town. There was a tech hub there. They have great medical. So that there are some hidden gems out there like Boise, like St. George's, Utah, where unfortunately prices escalated as people moved in largely from places like California. But you can still find places like Nashville, like Raleigh, Charlotte, Charlestown, places in Florida like Tampa, Jacksonville. There are places like that in the South and Southeast, Atlanta, a great city. And a lot of them are, you know, kind of cleaner and safer than what we're seeing in some of the major metros that people used to flock to.
That was amazing because, you know, a lot of Californians were moving next door to Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a client that was thinking of going there, and actually prices in Scottsdale were more expensive than San Diego. That just blew me away.
So Phoenix and Scottsdale became sort of ground zero for investors as well. And so when you had the combination of people migrating from other states to Arizona, and really the only place they migrate is that Phoenix, Scottsdale area, and investors looking to buy up assets to rent out, it really did drive prices up pretty significantly. So those prices skyrocketed over the last couple of years. And not surprisingly because of that, that's one of the markets where we're seeing double-digit price declines today. It's a kind of moving target, Jim. Phoenix used to be one of those places. Las Vegas used to be one of those places. But, you know, people are also looking for more balanced lifestyles. And, you know, in Phoenix, you must like heat or you're not going to live well there. And so, you know, people in some cases are moving to where they can get four seasons, or if they really like more tropical climes, they head off to Florida, which is still remarkably affordable, even though it's the state with the largest number of people from out of state moving in. So the bottom line is there are a lot of good places to live. Apparently, a lot of people are moving to Ohio. Columbus is a very popular market for young professionals to move into because of the job situation there and educational opportunities and great medical facilities. So the bottom line is if you're looking to be a homeowner, can't afford where you live, there are probably other places that would welcome you with open arms.
I want to turn the attention to the commercial market right now. It's estimated that 2,300 stores will shut down this year, everybody from Best Buy to Macy's to Nordstrom's, and over 50,000 in the next 5 years. So let's talk about commercial real estate. You and I were talking just before we went on the air. Article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday talking about two major hotels in San Francisco that are basically filing for bankruptcy. They're in default. That's Park 55 and the Hilton. Hotels are moving out of the area. They can't make it. What about commercial real estate now? What do you see happening there?
I think commercial is going to take a bigger hit this cycle than residential will. And that's starkly different than what happened during the Great Recession a decade or so ago. Yeah, the San Francisco situation is probably ground zero for commercial real estate problems. The company that was on the mortgage for the Park 55 and Hilton announced it was defaulting on a $725 million loan because it wasn't in the best interest of its shareholders to keep making payments because they just have not been able to recover from COVID. And San Francisco, again, is kind of a classic case in point. For years, San Francisco kind of proudly wore it on its sleeve that it was not terribly friendly to businesses. And COVID apparently gave a lot of those businesses a chance to return the favor and leave the city. So the downtown vacancy rates in the offices there are somewhere between 45 and 50%. There's an office building that last sold for $280 million a few years ago that's listed today for $60 million. And the office market, I think, is probably the catalyst that makes the rest of the commercial market a little bit vulnerable. There are a couple parts of the commercial market because it's probably not terribly accurate to cover the whole industry with a blanket. The industrial sector probably will continue to be pretty healthy. Work from home has created a need for computing centers, and they tend to pop up so that people can work wherever they happen to be. We've also seen a huge groundswell of buildup of warehouse and distribution centers for e-commerce, which is one of the reasons the brick and mortar retailers are struggling a little bit. And the cannabis industry has actually benefited the industrial sector as well. And then we talked about multifamily a little bit earlier and how healthy that still is. But if you look at some of the other sectors, hotel, office, and retail, there's going to be some struggles. And I was recently up in Los Angeles with my wife, and we were taking a look at all the vacant storefronts up there and all the vacant office buildings, offices with, you know, leasing signs out. And it kind of becomes clear about the waterfall that could be a problem for the commercial real estate market. Those office buildings at 50% capacity aren't going to support the local businesses that relied on those office workers to visit them for lunch or get the dry cleaning done or whatever those services were. And so those little businesses are going belly up, which hits the retail sector pretty hard. And, you know, if you take that far enough to an extreme, the so-called doom loop that economists refer to, you know, at some point people look around and say, well, I'm not working in the city and all those amenities I used to like have closed up. So maybe I shouldn't be living in the city anymore. It's not as attractive as it used to be. And so that could ultimately affect the residential market. But I'm expecting that the office market will probably be the most damaged as long-term leases have expired and there's nobody looking to take on a new lease, and that retail and hotel markets are going to struggle selectively. Interestingly, Jim, probably, and this goes back to the residential conversation, but I don't think retail struggles as much in the South and Southeast because those are still markets we're seeing population grow and job growth. And if you have those two factors, retail tends to do pretty well. So I think a lot of this is going to be localized and regionalized as well.
It's going to be interesting to see with this migration. I mean, California, you and I both live here. I moved here 40 years ago, and it's almost becoming, oh, it's beginning to look like a third world area in many places. We got potholes all around us. We've got homeless camps and crime running rampant. So, and we're seeing, as you mentioned, what do we lose? About 500,000 people out of California. They're probably moving elsewhere. So I think you're going to see the demographics of the United States shift because places like New York having the same problem, Chicago, same problem, California, same problem. A lot of these blue state people are just simply moving. They've had enough. It's too risky and too expensive.
You named the top three states, Jim. So you've done your homework, obviously, but all three of those states lost over six figures in terms of how many people exited versus how many people migrated in. And I think California is, like, if you look at the major cities in California, is where you're seeing most of the devastation. I didn't mention when we were in LA that the homeless problem up there is extraordinary. It doesn't get as much press as San Francisco's, which is probably worse. But you mentioned the same thing in San Diego. Now, interestingly, if you're out in the suburbs, things don't feel as bad. But, you know, you kind of reap what you sow. And when you pass legislation in a city like San Francisco that says if you steal anything less than $1,000, it's now a misdemeanor. And the likelihood is that you're never going to be prosecuted for that theft. You know, amazingly enough, crime goes up. And as crime goes up, retailers and other businesses exit the city because they can't protect not just their inventory, but their employees. So there's some really bad legislation on the books, which is leading to some really bad living conditions. And California is just has this weird dichotomy of probably the richest people in the country and the most abject poverty in the country. It's a really confusing place to be these days.
Yeah, they're working on a new piece of legislation where you can't arrest a shoplifter. So you're going to get more of it. Rick, as we close, well, let me sum up here. So if you're a young couple and you're living in a place like New York, Chicago, or California, you probably want to move if you want to eventually own a home someday. Would that be the case?
Unless the First National Bank of Dad can finance your purchase of your first home. Yeah, you're probably better off moving and looking for a more affordable place to live.
All right. Well, listen, Rick, if our listeners would like to follow all the great work you do on following the real estate market, both residential and commercial, how could they do so?
You can certainly follow me on Twitter. It's just Rick Sharga, S-H-A-R-G-A. Reach out to me on LinkedIn. Mention that you're a friend of Jim so that I know where you're coming from. I get a lot of odd requests to connect on LinkedIn these days. Or you can visit my website, which is cjpatrick.com, and find me there.
All right, Rick. Listen, good talking to you. And I guess we're diehards. We're staying here in California despite all this. So
at least for now.
Yeah, at least for now, unless they just make it worse. All right. Thanks so much.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.